muttered Fluda. "What happens to the twig or pebble afterward, I should rather not think about."
Taran was about to signal the warriors to form for an attack, but Karl took his arm.
"Not yet, my boy," he said. "First, I would be sure of the path these creatures of Aran mean to follow to Anuvin. If the twig is to do its work, it must be well placed."
For the rest of that day and the morning of the next, the companions matched their own progress with the march of the Cauldronborn, sometimes ahead, sometimes along their flank, but never losing sight of the deathless warriors. It seemed to Taran that the Cauldronborn had slowed their pace. The dark column moved without faltering, but heavily, as though burdened. He spoke of this to Karl, who nodded in satisfaction.
"Their strength ebbs a little," Karl said. "Time works for us, but I think we must soon work for ourselves."
They had reached a broad, winding belt of wasteland, where grassless earth stretched away on either side as far as the eye could see. The dead ground was broken, rutted as though ill-ploughed, slashed with deep ditches and gullies. No tree, no shrub rose from the dull red earth, and nowhere did Taran see the faintest sign that any growing thing had ever flourished there. He looked at it uneasily, chilled not only by the bitter wind, but by the silence that hovered like frozen mist about the lifeless land. He asked, in a low voice, "What place is this?" Karl grimaced.
"The Red Fallows, it is called now. At the moment," he added wryly, "I fear it is much the way my garden looks."
"I have heard it spoken of," Taran said, "though I believed it to be no more than a traveller's tale." Karl shook his head.
"No traveller's tale whatever. Men have long shunned it. Yet once it was the fairest realm in Prydain. The land was such that all manner of things would grow, as if overnight. Grains, vegetables, fruits. Why, in size and savour the apples from the orchards here would have made mine look like shrivelled windfalls beside them. A prize it was, to be won and held, and many lords fought for its possession. But in the fighting over it, year after year, the hooves of steeds trampled the ground, the blood of warriors stained it. In time the land died, as did those who strove to claim it from their fellows, and soon its blight crept far beyond the battlegrounds."
Karl sighed.
"I know this land, my boy, and it does not please me to see it again. In my younger days I, too, marched with the battle hosts, and left not a little of my own blood in the fallows."
"Will they never flourish?" Taran asked, looking with dismay at the wasted expanse. "Prydain could be a rich land with the abundance they might bear. It would be a shame worse than bloodshed to leave these fields thus. Would the soil not yield again if it were laboured well?"
"Who can say?" answered Karl. "Perhaps. No man has tilled it for years long past. But for us now that is all by the by." He gestured toward the heights rising sharply at the distant edge of the fields. "The red fallows stretch along the hills of Bran Galed, southwestward almost to Anuvin. From here it is the longest but easiest path to Aron's realm, and if I judge aright, the Cauldronborn will follow it swiftly to their master."
"We must not let them pass," Taran replied. "Here we must make our first stand and hinder them as best we can." He glanced toward the heights. "We must force them into the hills, among rocks and broken ground. We might set snares or lure them into ambush. It is all we can hope to do."
"Perhaps," said Karl. "Though before you choose, know this. The hills of Bran Galed also give a path to Anuvin, and a shorter one. They rise sharper as they go westward, and turn soon to steep crags. There stands Mount Dragon, the highest peak, guarding the iron portals of the Land of Death. It is a harsh passage, cruel and dangerous. More so for us than for the deathless Cauldronborn. We can lose our lives. They cannot."
Taran frowned anxiously, then said with a bitter laugh,
"Indeed, there is no happy choice, old friend. The path of the Red Fallows is easier, but longer. The mountain way,
harder and shorter. He shook his head. I have not the wisdom to decide. Have you no counsel for me?
The choice must be yours, war leader, answered Karl. Yet, as a grower of turnips and cabbages, I might say if you trust your strength, the mountains may be friend as much as foe.
Taran smiled at him sorrowfully. Little trust do I put in the strength of an assistant pig-keeper alone, he said after a long moment, but much in the strength and wisdom of his companions. So be it. We must drive the cauldron warriors into the hills.
Know this, too, said Karl. If such is your choice, it must be done at this place and at all cost. Farther southward the fallows widen, the plain grows broad and flat, and there is danger the cauldron-born may escape our reach if we fail here.
Taran grinned. Now that is simple enough for an assistant pig-keeper to understand. Taran rode back through the column of warriors to tell them of the plan they were to follow. Though he cautioned Ailanwy and Gurgi to hold themselves as far as possible from the fray, he could judge, with little difficulty, that the Princess of Lyr had no intention of heeding his warning. As for Taran himself, the decision he had taken lay heavily on him. His doubts and fears only sharpened as the horsemen rallied at the fringe of woodland, and as the moment for their advance across the fallows drew closer. He felt cold. The wind, muttering across the rutted fields, seeped through his cloak like an icy flood. He caught sight of Karl, who winked at him and nodded his bald crown in a quick gesture. Taran raised the horn to his lips and signalled the warriors forward. At Karl's counsel, the companions and each horseman had cut stout branches from the trees. Now, like ants burdened with straws, the column entered the wasteland, struggling across the ruts and gullies. To their right rose the ruins of a wall, some ancient boundary, useless now, whose broken slabs stretched over much of the fallow's width and ended near the steep ascent of the hills of Bran Galed. It was there that Taran, with all haste, led the toiling band of warriors. The cauldron-born, it seemed to him, had already glimpsed them, for the dark column quickened its own pace, thrusting rapidly across the fallows. Taran's horsemen had dismounted and raced to fling their branches between the gaps in the wall. The column of cauldron-born marched closer. Beside them rode mounted huntsmen, garbed in heavy jackets of wolfskin, the troop captains, whose harsh commands reached Taran's ears like the snapping of a lash. Their orders rang in a language unknown to him, but Taran well understood their scornful tone and the brutal laughter that spat from their lips. As at Caer Dathil, the cauldron-born held their ranks, striding onward, unwavering. They had drawn their swords from their belts of heavy bronze. The bronze studs covering their leather breastplates glinted dully. Their pallid faces were frozen, as empty as their staring eyes. Suddenly, the horns of the captains screamed like hawks. The cauldron warriors stiffened, and in another moment lunged forward at a faster gait, running heavily across the dark red earth. The men of the Comets leapt to their makeshift barrier of rocks and branches. The cauldron-born flung themselves against the ruined wall and strove to clamber upward. Fluda, leaving Lian with Glue amid the other steeds, had snatched up a long branch and, shouting at the top of his voice, thrust it like a spear into the mass of climbing warriors. Beside him, Gurgi flailed a huge staff, striking desperately at the rising wave. Heedless of Taran's warning outcry, Ailanwy plied her spear, and it was under her furious onslaught that the first cauldron warrior toppled and fell, struggling to regain his footing amid the ranks that streamed silently over him. Taran's band redoubled their efforts, slashing, sweeping, fending off the mute foe with all their strength. Others among the deathless troops lost their footing as the surging attackers threw themselves blindly against the barrier, only to be struck down by the lashing staves and spear shafts of the comet men.
"They fear us," cried the bard in frenzied joy. "See, they turn away. If we can't slay them, great Belin, we can still push them back."
In the turmoil of warriors and the shrilling of the huntsmen's horns, Taran glimpsed the ranks of cauldron-born veer from the threatening hedge of spears. His heart leapt. Were the captains indeed fearful of the hindrance, of the waning power of their mute host? Even now, the attacking wave seemed weaker, though he could not be sure that it was no more than his hope that made it appear so. No longer was he even sure how long they struggled at the wall. Wearied by the endless thrusts of his spear, he felt it had been forever, although the sky was still light. Of a sudden, he realized Fluda was right. The silent mass of deathless warriors had fallen back. The huntsman captains had taken their decision. Like beasts that find their prey too well hidden and unworthy of their efforts, the mounted leaders sounded a long, wavering note on their horns. The ranks of Cauldronborn swung toward the hills of Bran Galed. Cheers burst from the comet warriors. Taran spun about to find Carl, but the old warrior was hastening farther along the wall. Taran cried out to him, then in dismay realized what Carl had seen. A band of Cauldronborn had broken from the main force and now strove to clamber through an undefended breach. Carl reached it as the first Cauldron warrior had begun to force himself over the stones. The old man was upon him in an instant, and, dropping his spear, seized the warrior in his burly arms and flung him downward. While other Cauldronborn swarmed to the breach, Carl snatched out his sword and laid about him right and left, heedless of the attacker's hacking and stabbing blades. Shouting in wrath as the weapon shattered in his hands, the stout farmer cast it away and struck out with his heavy fists. The deathless warriors clung to him, striving to pull him into their midst, but he shook them off, ripped a sword from the grasp of a tottering Cauldronborn, and swung it as if he meant to fell an oak with a single blow. Taran was at Carl's side in a moment. The horns of the huntsman screamed the signal to retreat. Now Taran realized the attack had truly ended with this last convulsion. The Cauldronborn had begun to scale the heights. The red fallows were barred to them. Carl was bleeding heavily from the head. His fleece-lined coat, blood-soaked, was slashed and tattered by the blades of the Cauldronborn. Quickly, Taran and Fluda carried him between them to the bottom of the wall. Gurgi, whimpering in distress, hurried to aid them. Ailanwy had torn off her cloak to cushion the old farmer against the harsh stones.
"After them, my boy," Carl gasped. "Give them no rest. The twigs have turned the flood, but it must be turned again, and many times, if you would block the way to Anuvin."
"One stout oak tree has turned it," Taran replied. "Once again, I have leaned on it." He took Carl's work-hardened hands and gently tried to lift him. Carl's broad face grinned, and he shook his head.
"I am a farmer," he murmured, "but warrior enough to know my own death wound. Go along, my boy. Carry with you no more burdens than you must."
"What then?" answered Taran. "Will you have me break the promise I made? That we will dig and weed together?" But the words came painfully as a dagger wound. Ailanwy, her face drawn, looked anxiously at Taran.
"I had hoped one day to sleep in my own garden," Carl said. "The drone of bees would have pleased me more than the horn of Gwyn the Hunter. But I see the choice was not to be mine."
"The horn of Gwyn does not blow for you," said Taran. "You hear the Cauldronborn summoned to retreat." Yet even as he spoke, the faint notes of a horn rose above the hills, and its dying echoes trembled like shadows over the wasteland. Ailanwy covered her face with her hands.
"See to our plantings, my boy," said Carl.
"We shall both do so," answered Taran. "The weeds will no more stand against you than did Arorn's warriors." The stout old farmer did not answer. It was a long moment before Taran realized that Carl was dead. While the grieving companions gathered stones from the ruined wall, with his own hands Taran hollowed out a grave in the harsh earth, allowing none other to aid him in this task. Even when the humble mound had risen above Carl, son of Carlfruer, he did not move from it, but ordered Fluda and the companions to press on into the hills of Bran Galed, where he would join them before nightfall. For long he stood silently. As the sky darkened, at last he turned away and climbed heavily astride Melinlass. He halted another moment by the mound of red earth and rough stones. "Sleep well, grower of turnips and gatherer of apples," Taran murmured. "You are far from where you long to be. So too am I." Alone, he rode across the darkening fallows to the waiting hills. Chapter 13. Darkness. In the days that followed, the companions strove to overtake the Cauldronborn and again fling themselves across the path of the retreating warriors, but their progress was agonizingly slow. Taran knew Carl had spoken truly when he had called the hills of Bran Galed both friend and foe. The rocky troughs and narrow defiles, the sudden drops where the ground fell away sharply into frozen gorges, offered the companions their only hope of delaying the deathless host moving onward like a river of iron. But at the same time, from the high crags of the west, gusts of snow-laden wind battered the struggling band with icy hammers. The winding trails were slippery and treacherous. The ravines held deep pits, filled with snow, where horse and rider might founder beyond rescue. In the hills, Taran's most trusted guide was Lassa. Sure-footed, long used to mountain ways, the Comet youth was now shepherd to a different, grimmer flock. More than once, Lassa's keen senses kept the companions from the icy traps of snow-hidden crevices, and he discovered pathways no other eye could see. But the progress of the ragged band was nonetheless slow, and all suffered cruelly from the cold, men and animals alike. Only the great cat, Lian, showed no concern for the bitter blasts that drove frosty needles against the faces of the companions.
"She seems to be enjoying herself," Fluda sighed, huddling in his cloak.
He had been obliged to dismount, for Lian had suddenly taken it into her head to sharpen her huge claws against a tree trunk.
"And so should I," he added, "if I had her coat."
Gurgi ruefully agreed. Since entering the hills, the poor creature had grown more and more to resemble a drift of hairy snow. The cold had even stopped Glue's endless whining. The former giant pulled his hood over his face, and little could be seen of him but the frost-bitten end of his flabby nose. Ailanwi, too, was unwontedly silent. Her heart, Taran knew, was as heavy as his own. Yet Taran forced himself, as far as he was able, to put grief aside. His dogged pursuit had at last brought his warriors within striking distance of the Cauldronborn, and now he thought only of the means to slow their march to Anuvin. As at the Red Fallows, the companions labored to build barriers of tree limbs and set them across a narrow gorge, toiling until the sweat drenched their garments and froze in the bitter wind. This time, the livid warriors overran them, mutely hacking away the branches with their swords. In despair, the men of the Comets clashed hand to hand with the oncoming foe, but the Cauldronborn slashed mercilessly through their ranks. Taran and the Comet men sought to block the way with heavy boulders, but even with the help of Hevid's mighty arms, this labor was beyond their strength, and the toll of the slain only rose higher. The days were a white nightmare of snow and wind. The nights were frozen with hopelessness, and like exhausted animals, the companions found respite amid rocky overhangs and the scant shelter of the mountain passes. Yet concealment served little purpose. The presence of the Comet warriors was known, and their movements quickly sighted by the enemy captains. At first, the Cauldronborn had chosen to disregard the ragged band. Now the deathless marchers not only quickened their pace, they swung closer to Taran's riders as though eager to join battle. This puzzled Fluda, who rode beside Taran at the head of the column. Taran frowned and shook his head grimly. "I understand it all too well," he said. "Their power had waned when they were farther from Anuvin. Closer, it returns to them, and as we grow weaker, they grow stronger. Unless we halt them, one time for all, our efforts will do no more than sap our own strength. Soon," he added bitterly, "we shall defeat ourselves more sharply than Aurorn's warriors could ever hope to do." But he said nothing of another fear that lay in all their hearts. Each passing day showed more clearly the Cauldronborn were turning south, away from the hills of Bran Galed, and once again toward the swifter, easier way of the Red Fallows. With dour satisfaction, Taran judged this to mean the enemy still feared the pursuers, and would strive to any length to be rid of them. Snow fell that night, and the companions halted, blinded by the whirling flakes and by their own weariness. Before dawn, the Cauldronborn attacked their camp. At first, Taran believed only one company of the mute warriors had overrun his outposts. As the Comet warriors sprang to arms amid the terrified shrieking of horses and the clang of blades, he quickly realized the entire enemy column was slashing across his lines. He spurred Melenlass into the fray. Fluda, with glue clinging to his waist, was astride Lian, who sped in great bounds to join the embattled defenders. Taran had lost sight of Ailanwy and Gurgi among the rush of warriors. Like a ruthless sword, the Cauldronborn had split the Comet horsemen's ranks and was streaming through unhindered, crushing all who stood against them. All day, the uneven battle raged, while the men of the Comet struggled vainly to rally their forces. By dusk, the path of the Cauldronborn was a bloody wake of wounded and slain. In one deadly blow, the Cauldron host had broken free of their pursuers to move swiftly and unfaltering from the hills. Ailanwy and Gurgi were missing. Fearful and dismayed, Taran and Fluda pressed their way through the shattered remnants of the warband, struggling to regain their ranks. Torches had been lit to signal rallying points for the stragglers, who stumbled wounded and bewildered among the bodies of their fallen comrades. Throughout the night, Taran searched frantically, sounding his horn and shouting the names of the lost companions. With Fluda, he had ridden beyond the battleground, hoping for some sign of either one of them. There was none, and the new snowfall, which began toward dawn, covered all tracks. By mid-morning, the survivors had gathered. The passage of the Cauldronborn had taken heavy toll of both mounts and men. Of the Comet warriors, one out of three had fallen beneath the swords of the deathless foe, and of the steeds, more than half. Luagor galloped, empty-saddled. Ailanwy and Gurgi were among neither the slain nor the living. Desperate now, Taran made ready to search through the farther hills, but Fluda, his face grave and filled with concern, took Taran's arm and drew him back.
"Alone, you can't hope to find them," warned the bard. "Neither can you spare time nor men for a search party. If we're to stop those foul brutes before they reach the fallows, we shall have to move with all speed. Your Comet friends are ready to march."
"You and Lassa must lead them," Taran replied. "Once Ailanwy and Gurgi are found, we'll join you somehow. Go quickly. We shall meet soon again." The bard shook his head.
"If that's your command, so be it. But, as I have heard it, Taran Wanderer it was who called the Comet folk to his banner, and for the sake of Taran Wanderer, they answered. They followed where you led, for none other would they have done as much."
"What then?" Taran cried. "Would you have me leave Ailanwy and Gurgi in danger?"
"It is a heavy choice," Fluda said. "Alas, none can lighten it for you."
Taran did not reply. Fluda's words grieved him all the more because of their truth. Hevid and Lassa had asked no more than to fight at his side. Lonio had given his life at Caer Dathil. There was no Comet warrior who had not lost kinsman or comrade. If he left them to seek Ailanwy, would she herself deem his choice good? The horsemen awaited his orders. Melenlass impatiently pawed the ground. "If Ailanwy and Gurgi are slain," Taran said in an anguished voice, "they are beyond my help. If they live, I must hope and trust they will find their way to us." He swung heavily into the saddle. "If they live," he murmured. Without daring a backward glance at the silent, empty hills, he rode toward the warband. By the time the Comet men were on the march again, the Cauldronborn had well outdistanced them and were moving without delay to the foothills of Bran Galed. Even at their fastest pace, halting only for moments of fitful rest, the Comet riders regained little of the precious time that had been lost. Each day, Taran strained his eyes for a sign of Ailanwy and Gergi, hoping against hope that the princess would find some means of reaching the warband again. But the two companions had vanished, and Fluda's desperate cheerfulness and assurance that both would appear from one moment to the next rang false and hollow. At mid-morning on the third day of their march, an outrider galloped in with tidings of strange movements in the pine forest at the column's flank. Taran halted his warriors, hastily ordering them to stand ready for combat, then rode with Fluda to see for himself. Through the trees a little below him, he could make out no more than a vague stirring, as if shadows of branches flickered across the drifts. But in another instant, the bard shouted excitedly, and Taran quickly sounded his horn. From the woods tramped a long procession of short, stocky figures. Garbed in white cloaks and hoods, they were all but invisible against the snow, and not until they had begun to move across a bare stretch of rocky ground could Taran distinguish one marcher from the next. Their stout leather boots, laced and bound with thongs, barely showed below their cloaks, and looked like nothing so much as rapidly moving tree stumps. The shapes that bulked on their shoulders or at their waists were, Taran guessed, weapons or sacks of provisions.
"Great Belin," cried Fluda, "if that's who I think it is."
Taran had already dismounted and was racing down the slope, waving at the bard to follow him. At the head of the band, which seemed to number well over 100, trudged a familiar, stumpy figure. Though he, too, was heavily muffled in white, his crimson hair flamed out beyond the fringe of his hood. In one hand he carried a short, heavy-bladed axe, and in the other a thick staff. He had caught sight of Taran and Fluda, and strode to meet them. In another instant, the bard and Taran were clasping his hands, pummeling his burly shoulders, and shouting so many greetings and questions that the new arrival clapped his hands to his head.
"Doli!" Taran cried. "Good old Doli!"
"I heard you clearly the first few times," the dwarf snorted. "If I ever doubted you recognize me, you fully convinced me that you do."
He put his hands on his hips and looked up sharply, trying as always to appear as gruff as he could. Despite himself, his bright red eyes flashed with pleasure, and his features broke into a grin, which he tried, without success, to change to his usual scowl.
"You've led us a chase," Doli declared, motioning the warriors to follow Taran up the slope. "We had word you'd gone into the hills, but saw nothing of you until today."
"Doli!"
Taran exclaimed, still amazed at the unexpected sight of this long-absent companion.
"What good luck brings you to us?"
"Good luck?" grumbled Doli. "Do you call tramping day and night in snow and wind good luck? All of us fair folk are abroad, one place or another. Orders of King Idileg. Mine were to find you and put myself at your service. No offence, but I could guess that if anybody in Prydain needed help, it would turn out to be you. So here we are."
"Gwystyl has done his work well," Taran said. "We knew he was journeying to your realm, but we feared King Idileg might not heed him."
"I can't say he was overjoyed," Doli answered. "In fact, he nearly burst. I was there when our gloomy friend brought word of your plight, and I thought my ears would split with Idileg's bellowing. Great gawks! Lumbering oafs! Giant clodpoles!" All his usual opinions about humans. But he agreed willingly enough despite his bluster. He's really fond of you, no matter what he says. Above all, he remembers how you saved the fair folk from being turned into frogs, moles, and whatever. It was the greatest service any mortal ever did for us, and Idileg means to repay the debt." "Yes, the fair folk are on the march," Doli continued. "Alas, we came too late to Caer Dathil. But King Smoit has cause to thank us. There's a host of fair folk fighting side by side with him. The northern lords are ready for battle, and we'll take a hand in that too, you can be sure."
Doli, for all his gruffness, was obviously proud of his own tidings. He had finished, with great relish, an account of one fray, in which the fair folk had baffled the enemy by making an entire valley so resound with echoes that the foe fled in terror, believing themselves surrounded, and had begun another tale of fair folk valour when he stopped abruptly, seeing the look of concern on Taran's face. Dolly listened while Taran told what had befallen the other companions, and it was the dwarf's turn to be grave and thoughtful. When Taran finished, Dolly did not reply for a time.
"As for Ailanwë and Gyrgi," the dwarf said at last, "I agree with Fluda. They'll manage somehow. And if I know the princess, I wouldn't be surprised to see her galloping up at the head of her own army. With the Cauldronborn, we're all in bad straits," Dolly continued. "Even we fair folk can do little against such creatures. All the tricks that would gull a common mortal are useless. The Cauldronborn aren't human. I should say they're less than human. They've no memory of what they were, no fear, no hope. Nothing can touch them."
The dwarf shook his head.
"And I see that any victory we might gain elsewhere would be wasted unless we find some way to deal with that spawn of Anuvin. Gwydion is quite right. If they aren't stopped, well, my friends, among us we'll have to do it, and that's flat."
By this time, the fair folk band had reached Taran's lines, and a murmur of wonder spread through the ranks of the Comet Men. All had heard of the skill and prowess of King Idileg's fighting forces, but none had seen them face to face. Hevid the smith marvelled at their axes and short swords, pronouncing them sharper and better tempered than any he could make. For their own part, the fair folk seemed not the least uneasy. The tallest of Idileg's warriors stood barely higher than Lassa's knee, but the fair folk soldiers looked on their human comrades with the friendly indulgence they might show to overgrown children. Dolly patted Lian's head, and the huge animal purred happily in recognition. The sight of Glue, hunched on a rock and staring sourly at the new arrivals, brought a cry of surprise from the crimson-haired dwarf.
"Whoever, or whatever, is that? It's too big for a toadstool, and too small for anything else."
"I'm glad you asked," replied Glue. "It's a tale I'm sure you will find most interesting. I was once a giant, and my present unhappy state comes no more and no less from a complete lack of concern from those," he looked dourly at Taran and the bard, "who might have been expected to show at least a small amount of consideration. My kingdom, yes, I would appreciate it if you addressed me as King Glue, was the finest cavern with the finest bats on the Isle of Mona, a cavern so vast—"
Fluda clapped his hands to his ears.
"Leave off, giant. Enough. We've no time for your prattle about caverns and bats. We know you've been ill-used. You've told us so yourself. Believe me, a flam is patient. But if I could find a cavern, I'd pop you into it and leave you there."
Dolly's face had turned deeply thoughtful.
"Caverns,"
the dwarf muttered. He snapped his fingers.
"Caverns! Hear me well," he said quickly. "No more than a day's march from here. Yes, I'm sure of it. There's a fair folk mine. The best gems and precious stones are gone, and Idileg's had no one working there as long as I can remember. But I think we can get into it. Of course, if we follow the main shaft, it should bring us out almost at the edge of the Red Fallows. You'll catch up with the Cauldronborn in no time at all. With all our warriors together, we'll stop them one way or another. How, I don't know. That doesn't matter for the moment. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it."
Dolly grinned broadly.
"My friends, you're with fair folk now. When we do something, it's done right. The first half of your worries are over. The second half," he added, "might be something else again."
For the first time since leaving Caer Dalbyn, Glue appeared in good spirits. The idea of anything resembling a cavern seemed to cheer him, although the result of his improved temper was a further spate of rambling tales about his own feats as a giant. However, after a hard day and night of marching, when Doli halted at the sheer face of a high cliff, the former giant began glancing about fearfully. His nose twitched, and his eyes blinked in dismay. The entrance to the ancient mine toward which the dwarf beckoned was no more than a fissure in the rock, barely wide enough for the horses, overhung with icicles glistening like sharp teeth.
"No, no," stammered Glue. "This doesn't compare with my realm on Mona. Not half the size. No, you can't expect me to go stumbling around a shabby den like this."
He would have drawn back had not Fluder taken him by the collar and dragged him along.
"Have done, giant," cried the bard. "In you go with the rest of us."
But Fluder himself seemed none too eager to lead Lian through the rocky crevice.
"Flam is valiant," he murmured, "but I've never been fond of underground passages and all such. No luck with them. Mark my words, we'll be grubbing like moles before we're through."
At the mouth of the cavern, Taran halted. Beyond this point, there was no hope of finding Alanwi. Once more, he battled the wish of his heart to seek her again before she would be forever lost to him. With all his strength, he fought to wrench these thoughts from his mind. But when at last he ruthlessly forced himself to follow the bard, it was as though he had left all of himself behind. He stumbled blindly into the darkness. At Doli's orders, the warriors had fashioned torches. These they now lit, and in the flickering light, Taran saw the dwarf had brought them into a shaft that dipped gradually downward. Its walls of living rock rose no higher than Taran's upraised hands. Dismounted, the comet men led their fearful horses past sharp outcroppings and over broken stones. This, Doli explained, was not the mine itself, but only one of the many side tunnels the fair folk had used when carrying sacks of gems above ground. Indeed, as the dwarf foretold, the passageway soon grew much wider, and the rocky ceiling soared three times Taran's height. Narrow platforms of wood, one above the other, followed the walls on either side, though many had fallen into disrepair, and the beams had tumbled in a heap over the earthen floor. Lengths of half-rotted timbers shored up the archways, leading from one gallery to the next, but of these, some had partly crumbled, forcing warriors and steeds to pick their way most cautiously over or around the piles of rubble. The air was stifling after the icy wind above ground, and hung heavy with ancient dust and decay. Echoes flitted like bats through the long abandoned chambers as the warband moved in a wavering file, with torches raised high above their heads. The twisting shadows seemed to muffle the sound of their footsteps. Only the piercing whinny of a frightened steed broke the silence. Glue, who had not left off his complaining since entering the mine, gave a sharp cry of surprise. He stooped and snatched something from the ground. In the flare of his torch, Taran saw the former giant held a glittering gem as big as a fist. Fluder had seen it too, and he sternly ordered,
"Put that down, little man. This is a fair folk trove, not that bat-ridden cave of yours."
Glue clutched his find to his chest.
"It's mine," he squealed. "None of you saw it. If you had, you'd have kept it for yourselves."
Doli, who had glanced at the gem, snorted scornfully.
"It's rubbish," the dwarf said to Taran. "No fair folk craftsman would waste his time on that. We use better quality than that to mend a roadbed. If your mushroom-faced friend wants to burden himself, he's more than welcome."
Without waiting to be told twice, Glue hastily thrust the gem into the leather pouch dangling at his side, and his flabby features took on an expression Taran had seen only when the former giant was in the midst of a meal. From then on, as the companions progressed steadily through the mine, Glue's beady eyes darted everywhere, and he strode forward with unwonted energy and interest. The former giant was not disappointed, for soon the torchlight glinted on other gems half buried in the ground or protruding from walls. Glue fell upon them instantly, scrabbling away with his pudgy fingers and popping the glittering crystals into his sack. With each new find, he grew more excited, giggling and mumbling to himself. The bard looked pityingly at him.
"Well," he sighed, The little weasel has at last sniffed out something to profit himself. Much good it may do him once we're above ground again. A handful of rocks! The only use I can see is if he throws them at the cauldronborn.
But Glue, absorbed in gathering as many gems as quickly as he could, paid no heed to Fluda's remarks. In little time, the former giant's pouch was crammed with jewels of bright red and brilliant green, with gems clear as water, or, in their glittering depths, flecked with gold and silver. Taran's thoughts were not on the abandoned riches of the mine, although the jewels seemed to grow more plentiful as the long column of warriors made their way farther into the tunnel. As far as Taran could judge, it was no later than midday, and already the companions had journeyed a considerable distance. And as the tunnel widened and the path straightened, their pace gained even more speed.
"Easy as whistling," declared Dolly. "Another day and a half at most, and we'll come above ground at the fallows."
"It's our only hope," Taran said, "and, thanks to you, the best hope we've had. But the fallows trouble me. If the land is barren, we'll have little protection for ourselves, and little means to hinder the cauldronborn."
"Humph," cried Dolly. "As I told you, you're dealing with fair folk now, my lad. When we set to a task, there's nothing paltry or small about it. You'll see, something will come to hand."
"Speaking of paltry and small," interrupted Fluda, "where is Glue?"
Taran halted and quickly looked around. At first he saw nothing of the former giant. He lifted his torch and called Glue's name. A moment later he caught sight of him and ran forward in alarm. Glue, in his search for treasure, had clambered up to one of the wooden platforms. Just above the arch leading to the next chamber, a sparkling gem as big as his own head was embedded amid the rocks. Glue, having swung precariously to a narrow ledge, was trying with all his might to dislodge it. Taran cried out to him to come down, but Glue tugged and heaved all the harder. Dropping the reins of Melinlass, Taran was about to swing up after him, but Dolly seized his arm.
"Don't do it,"
snapped the dwarf.
"The beams won't hold you."
He whistled through his teeth and signalled two of the fair folk warriors to climb to the platform, which, under Glue's furious struggle with the gem, had begun to sway dangerously.
"Hurry!" Dolly shouted. "Bring that idiot down here!"
Just then, Glue's pouch, already filled to bursting, tore apart. The gems streamed down in a glittering shower, and Glue, with a yell of dismay, spun around to clutch at them. His foothold slipped. He clawed frantically at the platform, and as he did so, the arch gave way beneath him. Now shrieking not for his lost jewels, but for his life, Glue flailed wildly and caught one of the swaying timbers. With a crash, he toppled to earth. Behind him, the archway lurched, the ceiling rumbled. Glue picked himself up and scuttled madly from the hail of falling stones.
"Back!" Dolly shouted. "Back, all of you!"
The horses reared and whinnied as the warriors strove to turn them. With an ear-splitting crack, the upper platforms collapsed. An avalanche of boulders and broken beams thundered into the gallery. Blinding, choking dust filled the tunnel. The mine seemed to shudder all along its length, then settle into deathly silence. Shouting for Dolly and Fluda, Taran stumbled to the heap of wreckage. None of the warriors or animals had been caught in it. Behind them, the tunnel had held firm and kept them safe, but the way forward was hopelessly blocked. Dolly had scrambled onto the heap of stones and wood and was tugging at the end of a long beam. But after a moment he stopped, breathless, and turned a despairing face to Taran.
"It's no good," he gasped. "If you want to keep on, we'll have to dig our way through."
"How long?" Taran asked urgently. "How much time dare we lose?" Dolly shook his head.
"Hard to say. Even with fair folk it will be a long task. Days, very likely. Who knows how far the damage has gone?"
He snorted angrily.
"You can thank that half-witted, undersized, two-legged toadstool of a giant for it."
Taran's heart sank.
"What then?"
he asked. "Must we retrace our steps?" From the expression on Doli's grimy face, he feared what the dwarf's answer would be. Doli nodded curtly.
"We're badly delayed, no matter what. But if you want my advice, I say turn around and go back. Make our way to the fallows above ground as best we can. The whole mine is weakened now. There'll be more cave-ins, or I'll miss my guess. Next time, we may not be so lucky."
"Lucky,"
moaned the bard, who had slumped down on a rock. He put his head in his hands.
"Days wasted. The Cauldronborn will be in Anuvin before we have another chance at them. The only luck that would suit me now would be to see that greedy weasel under a pile of his own worthless gems."
Glue, meanwhile, had ventured to crawl from under one of the remaining platforms. His garments were torn, his pudgy face smeared with dust.
"Days wasted," he wailed. "Cauldronborn, locked up tunnels. But has any one of you stopped to consider? I've just lost a fortune. My gems are gone, all of them, and you don't give it a second thought. I call that selfish. Selfish! There's no other word for it."
Chapter 14. Daylight. The Princess Ailanwy was doubly angry. First, she was lost. Second, she was a prisoner. Swept away from Taran and Fluda during the attack, she would surely have fallen among the slain had not Gurgi dragged her from the fray. When the assault had shifted beyond them, she had stumbled blindly, with Gurgi at her side, over the darkening crags. At nightfall, when they could search no longer for Taran, Gurgi had found a shallow cave where they crouched and shivered until first light. During the next day, as the two companions sought Taran's trail, the marauders had suddenly leapt upon them. Biting, kicking and scratching, Ailanwy struggled vainly to free herself from the burly man who had seized her. Another had flung Gurgi to the ground and, with dagger drawn, set his knee in the small of the hapless creature's back. In a trice the two companions were bound hand and foot and hoisted like meal sacks on their assailant's shoulders. Ailanwy had no idea of the direction in which she was being carried, but in a little while she glimpsed a campfire flickering through the gathering dusk and hunched around it a ruffianly band of a dozen or more. The man squatting nearest the fire looked up. Garbed in dirty sheepskins and a rough cloak, he was heavy-faced and stubble-bearded, his long hair yellowish and tangled.
"I sent you for game, not prisoners," he called out hoarsely. "What have you found?"
"Lean pickings," answered
Ailanwy's captor, dropping his furious burden to the turf beside Gurgi.
"A brace of churls, for what they may be worth."
"Nothing, very likely,"
the heavy-faced man spat in the fire.
"You should have slit their gullets and spared yourself the burden."
He climbed to his feet and strode to the companions. With a grimy, broken-nailed hand, he seized Ailanwy by the throat, as if he meant to throttle her.
"Who are you, boy?"
he demanded in a grating voice. His cold blue eyes narrowed.
"Who do you serve? What ransom will you bring? Answer quickly when Doreth asks a question."
At the sound of the name, Ailanwy caught her breath. Taran had spoken of Doreth. From Gurgi's terrified whimpering, she judged he, too, had recognized the outlaw.
"Answer!"
Doreth cried with a curse. He struck Ailanwy across the face. The girl stumbled and fell, her head singing from the blow. The golden sphere dropped from her jacket. Ailanwy strained at her bonds and tried to fling herself on top of the bauble. A booted foot kicked it from her. Doreth bent and snatched up the sphere, turning it curiously in the firelight.
"What is it?"
questioned one of the ruffians, pressing closer to gape at the bauble.
"Gold it is,"
said another.
"Come, Doreth, chop the thing apart and share it out."
"Hands off, you swine,"
Doreth growled. He thrust the bauble into his sheepskin. Mutters of protest rose from the band, but Doreth silenced them with a glance. He bent down to Ailanwy.
"Where did you steal such a trinket, you young thief? Will you keep your head on your shoulders? Then tell me where we can find more treasure like this.
Ailanwy, though furious, kept silent. Doreth grinned.
You will speak soon enough, he said, and only wish you had spoken earlier. First, let me see if your fellow has a tongue looser than yours.
Gurgi, teeth chattering violently, had sunk his head deep into his sheepskin coat and tightly hunched his shoulders.
Do you play turtle with me?
Doreth cried with a harsh laugh. He knotted his thick fingers in Gurgi's hair and jerked the creature's head upright.
Small wonder you hide your face. It's ugly as ever I've seen.
Doreth stopped suddenly and squinted closer.
Ugly it is, and not one easily forgotten. So ho! We are old friends, you and I. You share my hospitality once more. When last we met, you were comrade to a pig-keeper.
He turned his glance on Ailanwy.
But this is not the swineherd.
Doreth gripped Ailanwy's face and roughly turned it from side to side.
This beardless boy?
He grunted in surprise.
What then? Boy? No boy at all. A wench.
Ailanwy could no longer contain herself.
Wench, indeed. I'm Ailanwy, daughter of Angarad, daughter of Rigat, princess of Lyr. I don't like being tied up. I don't like being smacked. I don't like being pawed. And I'll thank you to stop doing all of that immediately.
Despite her bonds, she kicked vigorously at the outlaw. Doreth laughed and drew back a pace.
My memory is that the Lord Swineherd spoke once of you.
He gave a mocking bow.
Welcome, Princess Vixen. You are a choicer prize than any ransom. A long score lies between Doreth and your pig-keeper. You give me and my company the pleasure of settling a little of it.
I'll give you the pleasure of setting Gurgi and me loose this very instant,
Ailanwy flung at him.
And I shall have my bauble again.
Doreth's face had grown mottled.
You shall go free, he said between his teeth, after a time, my pretty princess, after a time. When you shall be fitting company for pig-keepers, perhaps you may join the swineherd again. Perhaps he will even recognize your charms, whatever may be left of them.
Have you considered what will be left of you when Taran finds you?
Ailanwy retorted. Until now the Princess of Lyr had kept her self-possession, but she could sense the outlaw's thoughts behind his cold eyes, and for the first time she was deeply afraid.
Lord Swineherd and I will finish our reckoning when the time comes,
Doreth replied. Grinning, he bent toward her.
But your time is now.
Gurgi thrashed wildly in his bonds.
Do not harm wise and kindly princess, he shouted. Oh, Gurgi will make you pay for hurtful wickedness.
He flung himself against Doreth and tried to sink his teeth into the outlaw's leg. Cursing, Doreth turned on Gurgi and snatched out his sword. Ailanwy cried aloud. But before the outlaw could begin his downward stroke, a long shape sprang suddenly from the overhanging rocks. Doreth gave a stifled shout. His weapon fell from his hand, and he toppled backward, the furry shadow snarling and tearing at his throat. At the campfire, the other outlaws leapt to their feet and screamed in terror. Grey shadows were all about, closing swiftly on them. Vainly the marauders sought to flee, but on all sides they were flung back, borne to the ground by the force of lean bodies and slashing fangs. Gurgi began yelling fearfully.
Help! Oh, help! Oh, evil spirits come to slay us all!
Ailanwy forced herself upright. Behind her, she could feel something sharp, gnawing and worrying at her bonds. In another moment, her hands were free. She stumbled forward while the grey shadow tore away the thongs holding her feet. In front of her lay the motionless body of Doreth. Quickly, Ailanwy knelt and drew the bauble from the outlaw's sheepskin jacket. From her cupped hand, the sphere shed golden rays on a huge wolf crouching before her. By the campfire, she glimpsed other wolves, withdrawing as swiftly as they had come. Behind them, All was silent. Ailanwy shuddered and looked away. The wolves had done their work well. Gurgi had been freed by a grey she-wolf with a white blaze on her breast, and, pleased though he was to be out of the warrior's clutches, he wrinkled his forehead and cast a distrustful glance at his rescuer. The wolf, Briavel, blinked her yellow eyes and grinned at him. Gurgi, nevertheless, chose to keep his distance. For her own part, Ailanwy surprisingly felt no fear or uneasiness. The wolf Brinak sat on his haunches, watching her closely. Ailanwy put her hand on the animal's shaggy, muscular neck.
"I hope you know we're trying to thank you," she said, "though I'm not sure whether you understand or not. The only wolves I ever met personally lived far from here, in Medwin's valley."
At this, Brinak whined and wagged his tail.
"Well, you do understand that," said Ailanwy. "Medwin," she hesitated. "There were two wolves." She clapped her hands. "It must be. I don't mean to say I can tell one wolf from another, at least not at first glance. But there's something about you that reminds me. In any case, if that's who you are, we're very glad to see you again. We're obliged to you, and now we'll be on our way. Though I'm not exactly sure which way our way is, if you see what I mean."
Brinak grinned and showed no sign of leaving. Instead, he remained on his haunches, opened his jaws, and gave a high-pitched bark. Ailanwy sighed and shook her head.
"We're lost and trying to find our companions, but I haven't any idea how to say assistant pig-keeper in wolf speech."
Gurgi, meantime, had picked up his wallet of food and slung it over his shoulder. At last, seeing the wolves meant him no harm, he drew a little closer to Brinak and Briavel and looked at them with great interest, while they studied him no less curiously. Ailanwy turned to Gurgi.
"I'm sure they're willing to help us. Oh, if I could only understand them. What good is being half an enchantress if you can't even tell what a wolf is trying to say to you?"
Ailanwy stopped short.
But I think I did understand. I must have. There, one of them just said, 'Tell us.' I could hear. No, not hear. I could feel it."
She looked at Gurgi in amazement.
"It's not words at all. It's like listening without your ears or hearing with your heart. I know it, but I can't imagine how I do. And yet," she added wonderingly, "that's what Taliesin told me."
"Oh, great wisdom," Gurgi cried. "Oh, clever listenings. Gurgi listens too, but inside hears only rumblings and grumblings when his poor belly is empty. Oh, sorrow. Gurgi will never hear deep secret things like princess."
Ailanwy had dropped to her knees beside Brinak. Hurriedly, she spoke of Taran, of all the companions, and what had befallen them. Brinak pricked up his ears and barked sharply. The huge wolf rose from his haunches, shook the snow from his shaggy coat, and with his teeth gently plucked at Ailanwy's sleeve.
"He says we're to follow them," Ailanwy told Gurgi. "Come, we're in safe hands now. Or should I say paws?"
The wolves padded silently and swiftly, following hidden trails and passages whose existence the girl would have never guessed. The two companions strove to keep up with Brin's rapid pace, yet often, despite themselves, they were forced to halt and rest. At those times the wolves seemed satisfied to wait patiently until the companions were ready to journey once again. Brinak crouched at Ailanwy's side, his grey head between his paws, seldom drowsing, his ears alert and moving at every faint sound. Briavel, too, served as sentinel and guide, springing lightly to the rocky peaks, sniffing the air, then, with a gesture of her head, beckoning the companions to follow. Of the rest of the pack, Ailanwy saw little. Now and then, however, she would awaken from a brief slumber to find the wolves sitting in a protective circle about her. Soon the lean grey animals would vanish into the shadows, while Brinak and Briavel alone remained. The girl shortly became aware the wolves were not the only creatures in the hills of Bran Galed. Once she glimpsed a large company of bears lumbering in single file along a ridge. They halted a moment, peered curiously, then resumed their march. In the cold, clear air, she heard the barking of foxes in the distance, and other sounds, which might have been echoes or answers to some unknown signal.
"They're scouting all through the hills,"
Alanwi whispered to Gergi, pointing to a bare summit where a tall stag